Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you non-monetized, endorsement-free insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 140, I have the distinct pleasure of being joined by Dr. Audina Barakol of the Abascom Palmer Eye Institute. We cover a myriad of topics, including pediatric retinal surgery, gene therapy, staffing fellow surgery, and interviewing residency applicants. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by one of my colleagues and mentors, Dr. Audina Barakol. Dr. Barakol is professor of ophthalmology at the Bascom Palmer Institute in Miami, Florida, where she's also the director of the Pediatric Retina Service. In addition, she was this year's recipient of the Crystal Apple Award from the American Society of Retina Specialists for excellence in retina mentorship, as well as many other awards and honors. Dr. Barakol, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure being here. Thank you.
We have so much we can talk about, but we always start the same way. So every guest gets asked, why did they become a retina specialist? And now your story is a little more different because you have a father and a sister who are also retina specialists. But at what point in your life did you know that you were going to become an ophthalmologist and then do retina?
Well, that's interesting. I think being the youngest child of a family of where medicine was overwhelming, I think I fought it as much as I could. I majored in political science. I worked in Congress for a summer. So I even tried to be a paralegal at a law firm. And the head of the law firm, who was my neighbor, told me that he loved me too much to give me a job as a paralegal. So, you know, I think the universe was speaking to me, and I finally listened to it, and I decided to go into medicine. And even in medicine, I fought ophthalmology. I thought maybe radiology, or I even like urology, pediatric urology. But I think, I stopped fighting it, and I think ophthalmology came to me naturally, and, you know, retina came in naturally. I thought it was interesting, different, never the same problem. It was hard. You have to be a good observer. And then I love kids, so then the right combination came along. So it was Craig McEwen, my pediatric ophthalmologist in Boston, who said, Nina, why don't you combine the two things you like, retina and peds? And, you know, since he put that thought in my head, I think everything else just happened. When I stopped fighting it, I think everything came naturally to me.
So you have a practice where you operate on both kids and adults. And I think that's true of most people who do pediatric retina. But you're very busy in both avenues. So for what are the biggest differences for fellows, young attendings, between pediatric retinal surgery and adult retinal surgery?
Oh, my God. There are so many, but I think it truly starts in the clinic. I think that the relationship with the parents and understanding what parents go through when they bring your child to you with an eye problem, I think that's the biggest difference. I think you have to spend time. You have to understand a mother's neurosis about, you know, a kid with a problem. And apart from the time you spend at that in the office with parents and with kids in your office, I think it goes to the operating room. And I think, you know, you can't approach the eyes the same way. These are very different eyes. I think you have to understand that you're going to operate more than once, that you have to think about visual development. You have to think about going to school, being able to read. So, you know, there's so many layers to being a pediatric retina specialist that you have to understand that you're going to follow these kids for a long time. It's not just doing surgery like you do in an adult and, you know, you fix a detachment and they can go anywhere and they're going to be fine. This is something that you're going to have to follow. They're going to get a cataract. You have to remove the cataract, maybe remove the oil or replace the oil. So it's really something that you have to see the long outcome of these kids. It's not just one surgery. I think that's the biggest thing.
So one of the things you talked about was a relationship with the family, and we're going to delve into the idea of gene therapy. You performed the first LCA RPE65 gene therapy done here at Bascom Palmer once FDA approval was obtained, and that was on a kid who's gone viral, has become famous. He and his mom are just incredible people, and you know, one of the things you developed in was that relationship. We're going to talk a little bit about the surgery. Just comment a little bit, though, about the gene therapy. I mean, this is something that even, you know, when we were in training med school, maybe we talked about it, but it wasn't really something we thought we would see this quickly. How has this changed kind of what we think about these hereditary diseases and, more importantly, the outlook for these kids?
Oh, my God. I think this has first of all, given hope to so many kids out there and families that have been dealing with you know, degenerations of the retina and the lack of hope of seeing for these kids. And, it has truly been an amazing experience. As a physician and a surgeon, I feel completely blessed and truly, I guess truly blessed to be the surgeon to be, you know, injecting this, you know, viral vector into a 9-year-old's subretinal space so that they can actually be infected with the correct gene and start, you know, seeing better again. That to me is science fiction, and I've been doing it, and it's an amazing experience. And to see how, you know, the child really has become aware of the world around him and has changed even his personality, it's been really an amazing experience.
Let's talk about that surgery. It can be technically difficult, and it involves, we'll go through the steps, you know, involves doing, after the preoperative planning, you do a vitrectomy, and then you have to access the subretinal space. So right. What have you learned from a technical perspective that's been helpful for that portion of the procedure, injecting the subretinal gene therapy?
Well, I'll tell you that I think, you know, as anything, you know, we get better at it. And I think I'm in eye number 4, I became much better. And I believe that you need a contact lens viewing system. I don't think you can do it as well with a non-contact system. But, you know, removing the hyoid, and these hyoids become, they're very different, so they separate more easily. They're adherent at certain points a little bit tighter, so removing it, it's nice. I like to stain it to be sure that I'm removing it. Then, you know, magnify, get to the macular area and find, you know, that subretinal space, definitely better with the contact system. And then, you know, injecting into that space is a little bit nerve-wracking because you don't want to waste the medication. You only get 2 syringes per eye, so you want to be sure that you're injecting it. So, you know, now with time and the OCT, the intraop OCT, much better. The last case, I did it with a 3D heads up system, and I thought that was ideal for that surgery.
There's a couple things we're going to touch on, including the hyoid status, which is super important for surgery. But yes, Let's talk about some other pediatric topics. You know, you've okay. spoken a lot about, for example, you're one of the leaders in ROP now, and talking about using anti-VEGF for ROP. Let's talk a little bit about the philosophy of when you use anti-VEGF versus laser for ROP. You used to lecture us when you were residents about the importance, if you do laser, how important it is. That has to be absolutely correct. There's really, right. You know, it's very unforgiving if you do it incorrectly. And then how do you respond to people, you know, people who've spoken in adults, but also in kids, about systemic safety concerns with intravitreal anti-VEGF? Is that something that we should be worrying about? And if so, how do we modify the dose or the drug that we use?
No, those are great questions. But I will tell you, if you're gonna argue with me about you know, systemic,
I would never argue with you.
No, not you. But you know, if somebody's gonna argue with me about systemic, you know, absorption and what are we doing to a baby, I want you to please take care of a NICU, like 150 bed unit, like it's Jackson Memorial Hospital, and then after you do that, we can sit down and talk right. about it. Because I will tell you, you only have to have one child have, you know, APROP in front of your eyes, who's, you know, 32 weeks, 34 weeks. You have to inject them. You can't because they're too sick. So you know the idea of you know losing a retina because you can't, you know, you can't treat it as horrible. So I will tell you that in my unit in the last 18 years, I don't have a retinal detachment from ROP. And that I can say that because it's hard work and I'm, you know, very anal about what I do. So, you know, I think that if you, you know, when we only had laser, you know, you had to do it at the right time. You missed 1 week and then you knew that you were going to have bleeding and you were going to have, you know, macular, you know, issues. So What anti-VEGF has done is that it allows you to treat the very aggressive ROP. It gives you time. You know, if you miss a week, between 34 and 35 weeks is not going to be detrimental. Now, if you go from 34 to 38 weeks and you inject with anti-VEGF, you might get what they call a crunch phenomenon, and I think that's because you waited too long to treat. So, you know, there's something really nice about RRP that's very predictable. It has a time frame. You know, if you think in about RRP in weeks, it's very predictable. So, you know, I think that the way we teach it here to our residents and fellows, I think it's great. And I think that if they go out there into the community, they're going to be able to have the same outcomes that I've had. And when people talk about, you know, systemic absorption of you know, anti-VEGF, I probably agree that the dose we use is probably too high. But unless you give me a trial that tells me, you know, this is the right dose and this is the way we're going to follow, mm-hmm. I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing for the last 10 years with anti-VEGF.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, and finishing up on pediatric topics, it would not be complete conversation with you. I mean, I could spend an hour talking to you, but it would not be a complete conversation with you without talking a little bit about Zika, because, you know, we were zone ground zero for Zika in the United States. And, you know, you worked very closely with our colleagues in South America. For those, you know, again, trainees or even doctors out there who listen, who don't know, they've just read brief reports or things about Zika in the eye. What were kind of the big takeaways from that experience?
Well, I think that, you know, in Miami, for example, in all the screens that I've done, we only had one local infection, and that is in the literature. And we had one that came from Venezuela, and one that was infected in Haiti. But apart from that, we haven't seen any more. But I think it's something we need to have in our minds, because I think it's one of the torches. You know, now we think of torch plus we add Zika to it. And, you know, it's a devastating disease. If you're pregnant in the first trimester and you get, you know, you're infected with the Zika virus, it's going to be detrimental for your baby. Just as CMV and just as rubella and herpes, you know, all of those, same thing. So just, you know, I think people have to be aware of it and be conscious of it and, you know, do due diligence if you feel that a baby that's born has microcephaly or could have been exposed. I think it's all education.
Yeah. We have to talk surgery, right? So, because I love talking surgery with you. So we talk a lot about, for example, retinal detachment or any type of surgery. Let's talk about the hyaloid, because I think the hyaloid is something that as a trainee and even as a fellow, you just learn more and more about how it behaves and how it can be your downfall and how it can be sometimes very helpful sometimes, for example, to find a plane in it. So let's start with the basics, right? So patient, you have a retinal detachment, you have a fellow, you're trying to teach them, you know, about this, how to induce, for example, a posterior vitreous detachment. And now, again, you deal with a pediatric population in addition to your adult population. How do you get the hyaloid up? Do you always have to get it up? And how do you get it up in cases where maybe, you know, you're trying with the cutter and you can't really get it?
Well, I think, do you always have to get it up? No. I think that you have to think of what case you're doing, and remember that sometimes if it doesn't come up and you've tried everything, you might be doing more harm by trying to lift it than by leaving it there, maybe, you know, coming another day. But, you know, in kids, you know, the kids that come to me, they're gonna have real problems, and I usually need to lift it. So I have this technique where I use the macular lens, and I like to stain the hyaloid, and I like the flex loop to go radially against the optic nerve so I can get an edge of the hyaloid. Once I get that edge, I can use the same flex loop as a pick. I go under the hyaloid, lift it, and then I switch, go to the regular lens, and with the vitrector, I just continue lifting it. And I always like to lift it radially so you don't pull too much from one side, creating a tear somewhere else that you're not looking. So by doing it radially, you're lifting it all, you know, slowly and completely up until you can, you know, cut it and remove it.
Yeah, you showed me the loop originally. And I think the two things that I thought were really helpful when I started is one is there's a correct orientation to move it. If you ask any of the reps or look at it, there's one way that's correct that's less traumatic. There's one other way that may grab an edge but is more likely to traumatize the retina. The other thing is you always want to work posterior to anterior if you can, or at least in the same plane. If you start working the other way, it can be, that's not good.
Oh, I've regretted it. And I showed this video where I did that in a Stickler's patient, and I basically had a dialysis. And, you know, luckily it was superior and luckily I was able to fix it. But you know, I think you have to think of those things. And what happens is that, you know, you're trying to elevate it, you get frustrated and you mm-hmm. start doing it in a different way. And that's when you get in trouble. It requires patience.
Yeah, sometimes the fellows, like, we have very inquisitive fellows who ask me, like, oh, do you do this? You know, I'll do this sometimes in attachments if there's a layer. Do you do this in every patient? Or what? How do you decide to do it? Do you do it in every place? And I usually say, yeah, I do as much as I can until I feel like I'm either not making progress or I'm causing more harm. I'm at the verge of causing more harm than good. But no, my question for you, and I haven't mastered this, I always keep it extended to the maximum length, which is the safest because it's less likely, it's more bendy.
Yes.
Do you shorten it? Do you like change the length of it to change the tension on it?
Yes, depending on, you know, sometimes the retina's a little, if it's detached and it's an old PVR detachment, the retina's a little stiffer. Mm-hmm. So you can be short, you know, you can shorten it and be stiffer so that you have more grasp, you know, more pull.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it depends on the underlying retina, what kind of, you know, force do you want to exert?
I'm going to give you 2 minutes. So there's a whole crowd out there of people who go to these meetings and fellows go and listen to them and they hear, oh, you don't need to do buckles anymore. You know, buckles are outdated. You know, this is barbaric. And I'm not going to name names, but we know who there are people in our field. But and I'm not talking about people who say do buckle or vitrectomy. That's a separate argument. But let's just say people who say you should never do a buckle. Why would you ever do a buckle? It causes diplopia. It changes the refractive outcomes. And these patients have beautiful cataract outcomes who are pseudophagic. Mm-hmm. You know, so... Yeah. Let's go to the Dr. Nina Barakal side and say, I mean, what's the value of the buckle? Obviously, you're biased a little bit because you do younger patients, but you will use it even in older patients. So talk a little bit about the benefits of this and also the benefits of knowing how to do a straight buckle without entering the eye.
Well, let's talk about just something simple. If you have, when do you do buckles? If you have a patient that's in MIOP that detached, that has a lot of lattice and all that, you truly want to encircle that 360, in my opinion. The second thing is that when you have a PVR detachment or you have some peripheral traction, you know, you have to think of a buckle as a mechanical way to reduce that, you know, posterior-anterior-anterior-posterior traction, and the buckle will do that. So you have to think mechanically in the reason why that eye is detached, and then you will see that a buckle comes in very handy. And if you have a young patient that has a detachment, you know, a buckle is a great thing. You leave them phakic, they won't have a cataract. And honestly, they do so well, and it's such an easy procedure, you know. It's so nice and clean and fast. So I hate when I see from the community a patient that comes in and has had 5
mm-hmm.
pneumatics and vitrectomies, and they continue to be detached, and nobody has thought about a buckle. And then you do a buckle, and they finally flatten. So I think it's something that you have to have in your surgical armamentarium to fix detachments, both in adults and kids.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think sometimes right now, because we've gotten better at surgical techniques, we can lose the forest for the trees, right? So we talk about these refractive outcomes and, you know, we talk about maintaining that uncorrected multifocal 20/20 vision. And obviously, if all things are equal, it's good to do that. But I mean, surgical success rate with the primary surgery is probably the most important thing. And if you're doing the second surgery, it's the most important thing because that success rate drops with each surgery. We know that.
Right.
And you're putting the macula, let's say even if it's mac on the second time, you're putting the macula at risk another time if they detach. So it's a shame because, you know, you can really lose the forest for the trees when you do that.
Well, and you know, what we always say is that I've never regretted putting on a buckle. I've regretted not having a buckle. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. That's a great point. And so we talked a little bit about, you know, concepts for fellows. You obviously staff fellows, you've been staffing fellows, and you won the mentorship award from the ASRS this year for your mentorship, not only of your fellows when they're in training with you, but beyond. But let's talk about staffing fellows in the operating room. Advice not only for the fellows who are operating when they're starting, but maybe for someone like me who's a couple years out in staffing. I mean, what are the biggest... How do you approach that? Do you pass do you have a systematic approach where you're like, well, it's October and the fellows should be doing this, and now it's January, the fellows should be doing this? How do you approach that when you do pediatric cases, which are very complex and sometimes, you know, maybe be the only eye for a child? It's a really difficult scenario to pass those cases or to decide what can be done by what fellows.
Well, you know, I always think that it's very fellow specific. You know, I'm not the same attending with every fellow. I think different fellows need different things. So I'm not like that cookie cutter kind of attending. I think I try to find my fellows, assets and their lacuna or their knowledge of surgical lacuna or surgical lack of dexterity, if you may. And I try to really help them in the ways that I think I can enhance their surgical performance. And, you know, in some fellows, it means letting them do certain things more. And in others, it means letting them do less of something else. You know, I think, the beauty of attending, fellows is that you see them grow and you see how you can help them, not only surgically, but personally. You know, I think being in training and being in medicine is such a hard life, in general, because you've been in this system for so long that you forget, how to be, or, your life, or, the complexities of being a human being. So I think the OR brings all those things into play. And I think as an attending, I like to understand those things about my fellows. I think I can help them become better in more than just a surgical way.
Well, and let's talk about that growth, because you have now this whole group of former fellows who are out doing amazing things in academics and growing their careers. I mean, talk a little bit about advice for people when they go out, whether they go into academics or private practice, both for the men and also the women. I mean, because we have more and more women who are in retina who are taking a stand and being on the podium more, and we have more of an equal representation, at least on the podium. What are kind of your pieces of advice when someone leaves? Because I think it can be a little overwhelming when you start your career to kind of be like, well, I got to grow my practice and I got to manage these patients and I'm still developing as a surgeon. How do I stay involved? Like, what is your kind of approach to, and I can name again some names, for example, like Lisa Olmos, who's on the podcast earlier, amazing person, surgeon. Yeah. She's grown a career. She's the program director at University of Washington. And there are many others. What kind of advice do you give people like that when they first leave your fellowship?
Well, I think, the first few years is so hard. So the first few years is basically, get comfortable, get your practice going, think about your schedule, little guidelines of the day in and day out of their practices. But, I tell them in general, by this year you should join the society and you should at least write this many papers and maybe try to speak at a conference. So, there's a science to this, but you have to be conscious about it. And many times if people don't tell you, those steps, you forget because your life gets so complicated. Sometimes you're married, you have kids, or you have a family member that's sick. It's very hard, and then you forget about these other things that are important. So, I call my fellows, I ask them how they're doing, I invite them to meetings, and I ask them, did you apply for this or did you apply for that? So, not just because you left Bascom Palmer, it means that, we're done with you. For me, that means that I still have to, if I can, I can help you to really, accomplish your dreams outside of Bascom Palmer.
Last thing before I let you go, we have to talk about this. You've been sitting on the residency committee for many years, and last year was my first year on that committee, and just give us some pearls of wisdom. I mean, I think interviewing medical students is exceptionally difficult. It's difficult for the medical students because it's difficult to know what's important when you go to a program. And it's difficult for a program because medical students haven't worked as doctors yet. They're not full, they haven't graduated and they haven't worked in that capacity yet. What sort of things in your experience have predicted the people who go on to become good ophthalmologists?
Oh my goodness. I think that's a hard question because there's so many. We interview so many talented people. But I think that it's, you have to have that dedication, that understanding that, you have to work hard to obtain what you want in life. And I think being a team player, being a hard worker, being humble, being, helping others and really having a vision of what kind of life you want and a goal that you want to accomplish, that that says a lot. And you can see it with the residents at Bascom Palmer. You know, we sit in that room and you were there. It's 12 of us from different specialties, completely different, you know, personalities. And when we sit in that room, we all agree on who we like, which
it's
I
true.
Think
it's
is
pretty,
the
pretty
most
incredible.
Amazing thing. To this day, I'm amazed that we
teams
can
are
do
so
that.
Important. I mean, at least here. And I mean, for you, even a team extends beyond the physicians, right? It's the whole crew, right? You have such a, and you have an amazing team that you've cultivated and, you know, that almost like family for you.
Yes, that is correct. And I think when you treat people like family, you come to work happy and they know that you care. And I think it's so important to let people know that, you know, I'm here, you work with me, but, you know, you can be my technician or my plug coordinator or my scrub nurse. I love you all the same and respect you, and I really appreciate them. They make my life better.
Dr. Bearcall, thank you so much for your time, and we should do this again because we have more stuff to talk about. But
great. Thank you, Jay. It's been a pleasure.
I'll take care. Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's retinapodcast.com. All 140, yes, 140 episodes, including this one, can be found there, sorted by category. We have our blog on the website, Equal Round Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contest link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. We are starting a new submission opportunity for those of you who have a question or comment you would like aired on the show. Simply use your Memos app on your iPhone or the equivalent app on your Android or Google phone and send us an MP4 of your auto question to retinapodcast@gmail.com. Many thanks to Dr. Bearcall for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benacasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. Coming off the Thanksgiving weekend, we have so many reasons to be grateful. And as a group, we cannot forget to be thankful for our patients who give us the privilege of taking care of their vision day in and day out. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.